This is the spring team hearing, which is Decommissioned Natural Hazards and Whole Plan. Today, for this spring, there is only Commissioner Robinson and myself sitting at a council commissioner. And before I ask you to open for the council, we have a very large number of table evidence this time, and I thought it useful to just go through it for the record. Anyone who is listening to this one. We have table evidence from Ms. O'Sullivan on behalf of Queensland Airport Corporation Limited, from Ms. McMinn on behalf of the Minister of Education, from Mr. McCullum on behalf of Vodafone, Chorus and Spark, from Ms. McMinn on behalf of the Southern District Health Board, from Ms. Irving on behalf of Aurora Energy Limited, from Ms. Bolt on behalf of Transpower Limited, from Mr. Lyonson on behalf of ZBC, BP Oil and Mobil Oil, and from Mr. O'Flaherty on behalf of the New Zealand Police.
Thank you, sir. Just on three of those statements, the one that's been provided by Ms. Irvine for Aurora, the one by or from the oil companies, and I think you referred to Mr. Bolt. I don't believe we have seen them yet. Have they just been tabled this morning?
Well, Ms. Bolt, I think it was last week, but a revised version came in yesterday. Ms. Irving was some time ago. It's really just a statement saying that they were heard on those matters earlier and maintain the same position. And who was the third one? Did you said
the oil companies.
The oil companies. From memory, I think that was Friday. So I can tell you by the date that I've put on the website, on the site that we have. These are the oil companies was put on the site on the 13th. That was yesterday, so it must have come in recently.
Okay. Thank you.
Assuming
that the evidence just says that they're relying on early evidence that has been filed, the council's experts have taken into account all of the relevant evidence filed in earlier hearings, and so it already has been taken into account. But I will have a read of those statements over the agenda.
Yes, certainly. If you find anything in the evidence, make further submissions on after lunch. That's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was helpful. First of all, my apologies for lateness. I understand there are a couple of our free schedule for this afternoon that we can carry on into.
Yes, we have no pressure this week.
Fantastic. There's been very limited number of statements of evidence filed, and I understand some others who wish to appear at this hearing. In terms of documentation, you have, I understand, in front of you a copy of my legal submissions. I also understand that you have a copy of the three evidence summaries that have been filed for the council, and also an additional updated version of the natural hazards chapter that has been handed up this morning. So turning to the written legal submissions, section 1, introduction, these outline essentially the two chapters and the topics that are the subject of this hearing. I just wish to note in terms of the definitions chapter that recommendations on the majority of submissions have already been made through previous hearings on the proposed district plan, where Section 42A authors consider the submissions at the same time as they were considering substantive and related provisions on a certain topic. Submission points were allocated and submitters invited to the respective hearings. From a definitions perspective, the purpose of this hearing is to collate the Council's recommendations on definition-related submissions from those previous hearing streams and to address the small number of submissions on the definitions chapter that had not been previously addressed.
Can I just interrupt you on that point? The point you made, submission points were allocated and submissions invited to the respective hearings. I would really like Ms. Leith to go through and check that, because when I checked the appendix 2 to the Section 42A report for the rural stream, the Mount Cabrona station submission specifically on the definition was not listed. And I just want to make sure that in fact everyone, when they were summarised, well, Mount Cabrona station was certainly notified of that hearing, they weren't notified in terms of that submission point. And I just want to be sure that all of the relevant submission points have been properly notified and we haven't left a hole somewhere.
Thank you.
Procedural gap, if you like.
Yes, thank you. Point noted. We will look into that. Just to add as well that I understand all submitters on definitions have also been invited to this hearing as well.
Yeah, that's fine. And the other question I wanted to raise in terms of this, in terms of the way the hearing panel handles this, is whether the appropriate way might be for this panel to ask those other panels which have dealt with definitions to report to us on their findings, so that if there's anything that comes out of this hearing that requires an amendment or alteration to their findings, we can internally say that we have been reported to on all the evidence and submissions made on the matter.
Yes, I will seek confirmed instructions on that from the Council that seems a sensible approach. And just to add to that, where a submission on a particular definition has been considered in the context of a particular chapter, say rural, and that definition might have been building, that term is obviously used in other chapters of the proposed district plan, and therefore the purpose of this hearing has been to bring together any recommendations and to ensure that they align and to ensure that the definition works in each of the judicial policies and rules that it is used in throughout stage one of the proposed district plan.
I think that the way I envisage it occurring is that in terms of the rhetorical question that Mr. Goldsmith has posed in his submissions, this panel will be making recommendations on all of the definitions, but informed by the input of the other panels that have previously considered those issues as part of their consideration of where the term is used.
Yes, and that is also my understanding. Moving to paragraph 1.3, in relation to the whole of plan portion of this hearing. This is to assess submission points that were lodged against the entire proposed district plan, or were summarised as general comments on the entire proposed district plan, rather than against individual chapters, specific provisions, maps or properties. These submissions were generally so broad in nature that they could not be attributed to a specific chapter or provisions. and I will return to the whole of that portion later in my written submissions. With your leave, sir, I think I can probably take the rest of section one as read.
I have a query about just when you thought it was safe, about your cross reference to previous submissions ending in Colonial Vineyard, and this in fact bears out how you and report writers have written it, written it up. My query is that in light of the High Court's decision in the Davidson litigation, whether we can still take as good law the instruction in Colonial Vineyard that we start with part two or we finish with part two, and whether our inquiry is now that we only have reference to part two if we find that the higher order documents in a natural hazards setting, being the operative and proposed RPS, are invalid, incomplete, or ambiguous.
So the Davidson case has raised some interesting issues from a planning perspective. I did notice the Environment Court released a decision last week which chose to not follow the direction in the Davidson High Court decision about the implementation.
That would be a big call.
Yes. And I apologise, I'm not aware if the appeal period for Davidson has expired yet, but
I can tell you it has been appealed, or leave has been sought to appeal it.
Thank you, that provides clarity. At this stage, and in the absence of any clarity as to the outcome of that appeal, there is some uncertainty as to what the Davidson case means. It does, and I expect, has some relevance to the summary provided in the Colonial Vineyard decision. And it may, depending on the outcome of the appeal, impact on the panel's duties in terms of its recommendations. At this stage, in the absence of an appeal, given that we have an appeal, I think that is a matter that needs to be revisited by the council, possibly through legal submissions, once there is some certainty as to an outcome from the Court of Appeal. I understand that this council is not the only one grappling with the outcome of the High Court's decision, and there are other councils who are currently going through the process and are facing this uncertainty as well.
I suppose that if we were fortunate, the Court of Appeal will grant leave and will give us the guidance that we need before the hearing panel has to finalise its recommendations. If that fortunate circumstance does not arise, what would your advice be, or what would your submission be as to how we should treat Davidson? Should we ignore it?
I think I'd like an opportunity to provide substantive written submissions on that, given the implications of what the Davidson case does say. There should be some certainty reasonably soon as to whether leave to appeal is granted. If it is declined, that would probably be the correct time for those legal submissions to be provided to the panel. In this instance, if leave to appeal is granted, I would think it would be appropriate to wait until that process bears out and there is certainty as to the outcome, and at that stage further submissions are provided to the panel if necessary. Clearly we will need to keep an eye on timeframes as we move through this process.
It might require redrafting of reports, whichever way it goes, and it might be useful if the uncertainty remains past July, that you make some submissions on how we deal with it in the circumstances that we're left at that point, I think. I'm just thinking of the hearings that we've got coming up and the opportunity to do any amendments to reports that have already been drafted, which by July hopefully is everything on the text.
Yes, I think that's something I probably need to think through in a bit more detail, particularly in terms of timing. And the time frames for the subsequent, I mean, this is the last hearing on the text.
Yes.
And then we move into the rezoning hearings, is my understanding.
Mm. We don't want to leave the council with recommendation reports that have ended up being drafted on the wrong basis.
They were drafted on the correct basis at the time of drafting them.
Yes, but that's the time that the council makes its decision that's going to be appealed, not,
yes,
not that they were drafted in 2016.
Yes. I suggest that's something I think about and come back to you. I can speak to my client during the course of today, and perhaps if I have an indication of a response by the end of today, I can pass it on. Otherwise, we can file something by way of memorandum with council.
Okay, thank you.
Turning back to the written submissions, in section 2, I repeat here some submissions that have been previously presented to the panel. They are not so relevant in the instance of this hearing, but I just wish to note in paragraph 2.3 that in relation to definitions, Ms. Leith has identified a number of definitions that she considers on the merits would benefit from improvement, but that there is no scope within the submissions received on stage one to make or recommend these changes. As the panel has previously requested, Ms. Leith has provided her views on the merits of certain changes, and therefore, given there's no scope, those changes are not included in Appendix 1. I just draw your attention to footnote 8, which is where those definitions are listed, and I just like to add the definition of site to that list, which I come back to in the course of these definitions. In relation to natural hazards, Mr. Hanley, on behalf of the Otago Regional Council, has suggested a change to policy 28.3.2.4 to create a clearer, more measurable test for allowing hard protection structures. And Ms. Bowlines will advise the panel through her evidence summary that she considered that on the merits such a change would improve the policy. However, at the time of writing or filing these legal submissions and as of presenting them, no clear scope within the Regional Council submission or any other submission on the natural hazards chapter has been identified. To add to that, and this is something that still needs to be explored further, there may be a submission that seeks deletion of this policy completely, and that may create scope if the change that the Regional Council is suggesting essentially sits within the spectrum of no policy and the notified policy. So that's just to foreshadow some scope issues that do relate to recommendations that have been made by the Council. Turning first to the natural hazards chapter, section 31, 1, the one of the RMA provides that it is a territorial authority function to control the effects of the use, development or protection of land, including for the purpose of the avoidance or mitigation of natural hazards. While natural hazards do not relate to any matters of national importance in Section 6, Section 7 matters are of relevance and they are listed in footnote 9. I draw attention to the Resource Legislation Amendment Bill, which proposes to add the management of significant risks from natural hazards into Section 6 of the RMA. However, at this time, that change has not been made and it does not form part of the legislative framework and therefore is not relevant to the hearing. I do note that is something that may also change between now and the council giving its decision on the stage one chapters, including this chapter, and that is something that may need to be revisited depending on the timing of the RMA reforms going through.
Isn't that also dependent on where the transitional provisions are in that?
It will, and at this point in time, we can't. I can't speak to what they may be. There's still a process to be worked through.
It would be unusual for any RMA amendment that they to not have a transitional provision, which exempted stage one from dealing with the change.
Yes, that would hopefully be the case, but I'm not going to make an assumption that it will be at this point.
Yes, we have an unusual minister at this stage.
So that was just simply to confirm that at this point in time, the amendment bill and any changes within it to the RMA are not of any relevance. So in terms of context, the strategic direction chapter promotes the management of development in areas affected by natural hazards in a manner that balances the enablement of higher density development within the district's scarce urban land resource with addressing the risks posed by natural hazards. The purpose of the natural hazards chapter is then to provide a policy framework for the management of natural hazard risk throughout the district. The chapter's purpose recognises that the district is subject to multiple hazards. The position being advanced by Council is a risk-based approach to natural hazards. Broadly speaking, this approach seeks to ensure that the response to any particular hazard is commensurate to the level of risk posed and therefore is to be considered on a case-by-case basis. The objectives and policies of the Natural Hazards Chapter provide for the mitigation and avoidance of significant risk in the district to tolerable levels. This concept is derived from the Otago Regional Policy Statement.
Ms. Scott, can I just stop you there? I was going to ask 42A before we put this question, but I think you're probably start with you. The operative RPS uses acceptable. Mm-hmm. The proposed RPS uses tolerable. Are they the same thing in your view?
The answer is to that is yes. Ms. Bovines has made some recommendations to essentially change the terminology to ensure consistency throughout the chapter in response to the Regional Council's evidence that has been filed. I'm sure the ordinary dictionary wording is not exactly the same for the two terms. But in terms of the policy approach that is being put forward.
I suppose, doesn't that create a problem, given that we're bound to give effect to the operative RPS rather than the proposed one? Like, if we thought they were the same, then it would be a matter entirely within our discretion as to which term they use. But if they're different, don't we have to give effect to the operative one?
The concept of tolerability also comes from the operative RPS.
Well, I suppose, I read that statement, I pulled up policy 11.5.6 of the Office of RPS. Which you've referenced. And it says to establish the level of natural hazard risk for threatened communities are willing to accept. And 11.5.2, I think, also talks about unacceptable adverse effects. So I'm left sort of in a bit of a bind, thinking, well, obviously it would be desirable if the proposed RPS consistently uses that term to reflect and update it, particularly if there's a fine distinction between them. But I'm left with the legal obligation that we're currently in, that however outdated, that we're required to give effect to the operative RPS. So, what's the answer? To the bind.
Policy 11.5.6 of the operative RPS talks about establishing a level of natural hazard risk that threatened communities are willing to accept. So that is talking about the respective communities within the region, what each of the communities are willing to accept. So what is acceptable on a different in each of those areas. That is the same policy approach that the council is taking through its recommended through the notified and through the proposed chapter. I think that to give effect to a document doesn't mean you need to use the exact same language, and that there are different ways that you can give effect to or implement a higher order document. And that is what the council's recommendation is doing in this instance.
Is what you're saying that if a community is willing to accept a level of natural hazard risk, then that is the same as saying a community is prepared to tolerate that risk. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it is, and it's through the consent process where that conversation essentially will happen.
I'm more concerned about helping Commissioner Robinson get to acceptable and tolerate being the same thing, rather than whether they're using the consent process or the plan. So that's what I'm trying to get a handle on, is if you read that policy, whether one uses the word accept or tolerate, do they mean the same thing?
And if they mean something different, what's the difference?
Well, I think they do mean the same thing as I submitted earlier. I will leave Ms. Bowlines to also respond to this question, and perhaps she can front this through her evidence summary as well, given its importance. But if you, for example, change the word accept to tolerable in 11.5.6, then I don't think that would change the meaning of that policy.
That would actually be the same meaning.
Yes.
And if you go to the earlier one, which is 11.5.2, to mitigate unacceptable adverse effect, would you be able to put intolerable adverse effect in place of unacceptable and still retain the same meaning of the policy?
Yes, I think so. And that is something that has been why I stand as being considered in the course of decision making on the proposed RPS, but also through the mediation process which is underway. So in terms of that concept of tolerability, I just add that it is the same concept which is now in the decisions version of the proposed regional policy statement, which the district plan must have regard to. So the mapping of natural hazards is an integral part of how the council achieves its functions under section 31 of the RMA. The majority of natural hazards in the district are not recorded on the proposed district plan maps. There are three exemptions and they are specific flood hazard areas. They are not the only flood hazard or areas with flood hazard with them in the district, however they are. That's a rollover from the operative district plan that remains in the proposed district plan.
Ms. Scott, a question you may not know the answer to, but I'll put it on the table so that your team behind you can think of. If that's a rollover, from the ODP, do those flood hazard maps take into account predicted climate change effects on the extent and frequency of flood hazards?
I don't know the answer
to that. We'll just put it on the table for somebody to answer.
So natural hazards are mapped using the council's hazard database, which exists as an external tool and has not been incorporated into the district plan by reference. This means that the natural hazards information held within the database will not be used as a basis for an activity status and therefore will not trigger any requirement for a resource consent. Rather, the effect of policy 28.3.2.3 and the information requirements in 28.5 is that all persons applying for resource consent to subdivide or develop land that is subject to natural hazards risk are required to provide detailed hazard assessments along with their applications for consent.
I'm just wondering if that, both the policy and the information requirement, whether that isn't just setting the council up for future arguments between applicants and council as to whether the land is subject to risk. I would have thought the evidence was that every piece of land in this district is subject to the risk of earthquake shaking, at minimum. The level of risk is the issue, and you don't know the level of risk until you've done the work. And the way the policy is framed, it suggests that in some cases you don't need to do the work, but it may not be an accurate reflection of what is required of applicants.
The matter of having that conversation about the level of risk is something that the Section 32 report has considered, and it was weighed up in the course of recommending this policy framework within the district plan. It is accepted that may happen during or as consent or possibly before a consent is lodged or during the course of considering a consent. I don't think the council is at all saying that will never happen and that it isn't a possibility in terms of the outcome of the approach that it's recommending on natural hazards.
Can you clarify what you mean by that? Sorry, which way around is it? What the council won't accept?
The council has acknowledged in its section 32 that a possible outcome of this approach is that there may be debates or conversations during the course of consenting as to appropriate levels of risk. And that goes back to, I think, a comment by the Chair as to the level of information which is which is held in the external database.
It's not quite the same thing, because where the chair's coming from is that everywhere in this district is subject to some risk, but the policy implies that that may not be true, that there are areas that have no risk, and the trick is to identify where they are.
Yes, I think that's expected. The policy specifically refers you back to the database as to the information that will tell you as to whether there is an identified natural hazard for your particular area of land that you're interested in.
Well, I suppose the question then is, does the database identify any land that is not subject to hazard? And if so, where is it? That's a matter of personal curiosity.
I don't know the answer to that question. I will continue to explore it, and we can refer to the panel as to that.
Well, the information requirement says that the natural hazard information that the council holds should be taken into account. It doesn't say that it's determinative. Policy. Requires information requirements, and I know that the experience of this council on applications is even when there are known natural hazards, the applicant often tries or attempts to minimise the risk of those natural hazards. I'm not sure that suggesting that there are areas with no hazards is necessarily a helpful starting point. That's what I'm concerned about.
Yes, and I think there is some difference between policy 28.3.2.3 and the information requirements as to where you go to identify whether land is subject to natural hazards risk or not. The policy itself doesn't refer you to the external database, it's only the information requirements, and that is something that we possibly need to revisit.
I note also that the 28.5 at the end says that there are hazards that are identified as district wide, which in itself implies that there are no sites not subject to a natural hazard.
Yes, and I think my answer to your question possibly needs to be revisited. Given that the policy itself contemplates any land that is subject to natural hazards risk and doesn't focus your attention into the database as currently drafted.
Okay.
The information requirement also goes on to say that the natural hazards information held by the council should be taken into account when assessing potential natural hazard risk. It doesn't say that it's determined by it.
Yeah.
It's something we will think about. So turning to paragraph 3.9, an outcome of the proposed approach will be that Schedule 1 of the RMA isn't needed to make changes to the hazards database as it will sit outside the district plan. As we have already discussed, Ms. Bovines has identified and expected that this approach does not afford potentially affected parties with the ability to challenge the robustness of the hazard information through the Schedule 1 process. And that is something that may occur during the course of decision making on consent. However, it is the council's position that the dynamic nature of hazard information and the challenges of keeping abreast of new information through plan changes makes the non-statutory approach the most appropriate.
Just as a matter of interest, Ms. Scott, is there a process outside the first schedule for an interested party, most obviously a landowner, to challenge the robustness of the council's database?
If I may, I'll defer that question to she's nodding. Ms. will be able to answer that question.
I think Commissioner Robinson leaves outside of the consenting process.
Yes. So turning now to the decisions version of the proposed regional policy statement. We have filed more comprehensive legal submissions on the requirement to have regard to this document, and I have attached them to these legal submissions for your convenience. I just want to mention Mr. Hanley's evidence for the Regional Council suggests in some instances that the test is to give effect to certain parts of the decision version. The Regional Council has decided not to notify the parts of the proposed regional policy statement that are not subject to appeal, and therefore the relevant legal text, and that would have been under clause 20 of schedule 1 of the RMA, and therefore the relevant legal text for all of the decisions version is still have regard to. It's worth mentioning, and this isn't in my written submissions, but it then turns to a matter of weight that the panel gives to parts of the decisions version that are under appeal and that are not under appeal. And there is case law, it's the Keystone case, which basically says the further through the decisions making process that you are, the more weight you can give to such provision. And one of the relevant factors is that it's not subject to appeal, and it's beyond challenge, then you can give more weight to it.
Two questions that occur to me rising out of that submission, Ms. Scott. Having submitted that Mr. Hanley was wrong, should we take it that in those instances where your 42A authors also suggest that we're required to give effect to the proposed RPS, because there are a few, that you will counsel them as to the error of their ways in due course?
I'm sure we've already got that pushed out to Greece.
I believe
that is an error, and I apologise for not picking that up before they were filed. It is in regard to the Regional Council has confirmed that it will not be making any of the proposed regional policy statement operative, they have confirmed that with the Council. And of course, Section 87F doesn't apply because there aren't any rules in the policy statement.
And the other point, which goes to your question of weight, my instinctive reaction to this situation is that in those very few instances where the RPS is not the subject of appeal, I think that they are indeed few and far between. Would you agree? I'll put this in a leading way to Kim, so we're not beating about the bush. Would you agree that it would be sensible for this panel to implement parts of the proposed RPS that are not subject to appeal if we have scope to do that?
I think it would be sensible. My written submissions do then turn to this exact situation in terms of the legal text, but where they are beyond appeal, that is absolutely sensible, but it is not a formal statutory test for the panel to have to meet. And I've set out there an extract from the Winstone Aggregates case, which specifically dealt with a very similar situation to what we find ourselves in now.
when stone aggregates would have predated the legal obligation to give effect to an operative RPS2, wouldn't it? It's pretty old.
Yes,
1998. Yes, it would have been not in
existence. Yes, but the principle itself still applies in terms of not looking to the future. I will come to this shortly, but at paragraph 3.15, I do set out there some of the parts of the proposed regional policy statement that are under appeal by Dunedin City Council. I hope that that isn't misleading, because there are other parts of the regional policy statement that are that relate to natural habitat that are also under appeal. And I can list them for you. I don't want to imply that only those two policies relating to natural hazards have been appealed.
Have you analysed the appeal, the appeals on natural hazards?
The Dunedin City Council one. Yes, I'm just to confirm I'm not acting for the council on those appeals, so I haven't been attending the mediations or anything like that.
But my impression from my reading of the appeals is that they could go each way, because there is an appellant trying to harden up. If we might say the Dunedin City Council and indeed I think it's CODC are trying to soften natural hazard policies, and there is an appellant trying to push them in the opposite direction.
Yes. Interestingly, there is. I mean, we can't preempt the outcome of that process at all, but there are a number of appeals which have appealed natural hazards issues. There's the Rural Journeys appeal, who obviously have an interest in the Queenstown Lakes District. Wise Response, the oil companies who are submitted on the proposed district plan here. There's also an appeal by Transpower. And would it assist if I provided a list of the natural hazards related provisions that are under appeal?
I think we've already got the marked up version. I think the point of my question is that it's not like one of those situations where if it moves, it'll only move in one direction. Mm-hmm. You could move every which way.
I see that, yeah. There's a lot of uncertainty as to where it might head. And you obviously already have a copy of this version, but it does also form part of the bundle of documents that was filed on Friday by the council. So it is contained within our bundle of, you need a formal copy that is in front of the panel.
I can be
open there. I recommend that you use it electronically and do not print.
Yes, but I think, that as a matter of public record, I don't think we need submissions to tell us about that.
Thank you. So I think if I turn now to paragraph 3.14, this is a summary of the council's interest in the regional policy statement process. Ms. Bobines, in her Section 42A report, does summarise the council's interest and the council's submission. And the matters raised by the council in that process include the definition of significant risk, the impact of the avoidance policies on infill and existing development, the need for clarity in respect of the concept of tolerance, and the need for flexibility to enable consideration of hazards by a means appropriate for a particular local context. And as already mentioned, the council's joined a number of the appeals as a Section 274 party in relation to matters raised in that submission. And in particular, as I have foreshadowed, Dunedin City Council's appeal seeks that the focus of policy 4.1.6 be changed from avoid to manage, that the emphasis on encouraging design of activities that facilitate recovery, relocation and mitigation in that same policy be reinstated as notified, and that provision for design that mitigates risk be included in policy 4.1.7. So The point of their submission is that the Section 42A report on the natural hazards chapter was prepared in the absence of certainty as to the final form of the proposed regional policy statement, and that remains the current state of play. Ms. Bovine's evidence is that the natural hazards chapter is consistent with the decision's version of the proposed regional policy statement, insofar as it introduces a policy framework that takes a risk-based approach to natural hazards. And I use the words consistent with on purpose, and knowing that they are not the statutory test. They go further than the statutory test of have regard to. Further, Ms. Bovine notes that the Section 32 analysis prepared by the Regional Council acknowledges that the level of natural hazards risk that is tolerable to communities should not be predetermined. Rather, the approach provides flexibility for the varying levels of tolerance within the communities of the Otago region to be determined at a territorial authority level by way of consultation with those communities. Ms. Bovine notes that, in this respect, the approach taken in the notified version of the natural hazards chapter is consistent, and it's submitted to be the case with her recommended chapter as well. So Ms. Bovine has acknowledged that the decision's version of the proposed regional policy statement advocates for a more definite and cautious approach with regard to natural hazard risk than that proposed by the provisions of the natural hazards chapter. In particular, she acknowledges that the proposed regional policy statement seeks avoidance of development in locations affected by significant hazards, while the natural hazards chapter only requires avoidance where risks are intolerable. However, Ms. Bovine notes that the proposed regional policy statement decisions document provides the following reasoning. While the proposed regional policy statement provisions require the avoidance of certain effects, it does not automatically follow that an activity is prohibited. What is prohibited are adverse effects on particular values. If the adverse effects from that activity on those values can be avoided, then the activity can be undertaken. Ms. Bovine's view, this reasoning creates some uncertainty as to how the word avoid is to be interpreted in the context of the proposed regional policy statement objectives and policies. There, I don't mean she's confused as to the difference between avoiding an activity and avoiding certain effects, but that element of her evidence relates to the fact that the Regional Council's reasoning, as set out in its decision, doesn't sit particularly well with actual wording used in the policy. And that is about the difference between avoiding a particular activity and, of course, avoiding the effects of an activity, which are two different things and have become quite important following the King Salmon decision in drafting a plan.
So just so I'm clear, my reaction reading the passage quoted from the Regional Council decision with all due respect to the authors of that decision was that that's a blighting statement of the obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But that your point is more that it doesn't talk about, the policies don't talk about avoiding effects, they talk about avoiding activities.
That's correct, and that's the subject of mediation on the appeals at the moment, and that is some uncertainty there between the reasoning and what the decision version actually requires. And just to note, in having regard to the proposed regional policy statement, she has considered whether the relief sought by submissions on the natural hazards chapter provides an opportunity to increase consistency with the decision's version of the proposed regional policy statement. And that goes to your question, Mr. Robinson, as to whether that is a sensible approach, and of course it is. So the Council's recommendations have endeavoured to do that to the extent possible. Moving now to the precautionary approach. The reason this section is in the submissions is that the Regional Council submitted on the natural hazards chapter, requesting that it provide for the precautionary approach reflected in the regional policy statement, in the proposed regional policy statement. To foreshadow this section, the regional council appear to be aligned with the council on this aspect of the natural hazards chapter. And the reason I say that is Mr. Hanley's evidence for the regional council raises no objection with where the council has got to. So the relevant policy is 4.1.8, precautionary approach to natural hazard risk. This is under appeal through the appeals by Wise Response and Rural Journeys. So would you like me to take you through this part of the submissions, or can it be taken as read? I understand that there's no dispute now with the regional council as to where the recommendations in the chapter have got to. I can take you through it.
I think we can take this read. We've got people agreement.
I don't think it raises anything.
Which will obviously make questions, of course, of each of us, but I suppose, and just the handling of that.
The section simply sets out the case law that has considered what the concept is. So, just to wind up the submissions on the natural hazards chapter, in reading the section 42A report, the key outstanding issues set out relate to matters raised in the regional council's submission. However, from reading the evidence summary of Ms. Bowlines, you all have seen that there has been some movement in that position. The regional council's original submission sought general changes at a high level, whereas Mr. Hanley's evidence provides a more fine-grained response on each of the individual provisions within the redrafted chapter. Ms. Bowlines will advise the panel through her evidence summary that she largely agrees with the discrete changes now sought by Mr. Hanley. I understand with one exception, which she just wants to consider further, she hasn't rejected it outright. And that's essentially what I say in paragraph 3.29, so I will move on. Unless you have any more questions about the natural hazards chapter before I do. Thank you. Moving to definitions. So the definitions chapter is included in the proposed district plan to aid plan users in the interpretation of the substantive chapters. The proposed plan has been drafted with the intent that the defined terms in chapter 2 apply throughout the proposed district plan. That is whenever the defined term is used, with the exception of the designations chapter. There is no need for the stage one chapters to underline words where they are then used in their defined way, rather than the ordinary dictionary meaning of a word or phrase.
Although you say there's no need, can't it be helpful? I'm just thinking that the one that I'm familiar with that did that was the former Waitakere Council district plan, where the words that were defined were in italics, and so that one knew to check the meaning in chapter 2. Because every time the word is used, it is used in the same way. So it's not a matter of there being some uses of the word as the defined term, and there's some uses that's a dictionary meaning.
Yes, yes. I mean, there is different ways to approach this. The obvious and doable alternative is that they are aligned and underlined in every instance. I have some somewhat quite recent experience of definitions chapters in Christchurch, and the outcome there is that the definitions, the intention is that they be used in objectives, policies, rules, etc. And every time they are used in their defined term, they are specifically underlined. And there are instances where the defined term is not appropriate, and therefore the term is not underlined, and chapter 2 is not triggered. That's the approach that's been taken. There are slightly different approaches taken two plans throughout New Zealand, preferably there wouldn't be, and that might be something that changes, but at this point in time, this is the approach that the council's taken. I don't have instructions, but I don't think the council would object to the opposite approach, which is undermining the definitions in every instance.
Or put them in capitals, or...
Yes.
Or italic some way.
Yes. And I'm not going to get into an e-plan, it's not going to assist you. But there are advantages, and the RMA still requires that you have a hard copy and that is a formal plan, but a lot of councils are moving to e-plans, and there are benefits there because you can hyperlink immediately to the definition, which makes it a quicker use by the reader. So there are advantages in that instance. What is important is that the approach is very clear to readers, and that is that the definitions are used. Are triggered every time the term is used, and that is something that a note has been recommended to be added to the front of the chapter just to make that clear. Given my recent experience, I think things like this need to be made very clear from the outset, and it also avoids any potential for litigation in the future as to what the actual scope of the definitions chapter is. That is also the purpose of a number of the other notes that have been added to the front of the definitions chapter.
I have a question that arises from that one. Two questions. One from Ms. Bubb is as to whether she's satisfied that in every instance where a defined term is used, it is in fact used in the sense defined, because I thought that was a particularly bold statement, especially since I found what I thought was an exception, and the exception being that council is defined as Queenstown Lakes District Council, but section 1.3 talks about Southland District Council.
In response to that, Ms. Lee, it was section 42A for this chapter.
Oh, sorry, wrong. Lucky business.
This is a process that Ms. Lee, with assistance from other, I understand, section 42A authors from previous chapters has worked through in terms of checking the use of definitions throughout the chapters. There may be instances like the one you have identified that may require some amendments. That doesn't sound correct. It's not the purpose of council in this instance. I'm very aware of the amount of work it takes to do just to check, because any recommendation to an amendment to a definition needs to be considered throughout the entire plan, and that is something that the council is very aware of, given it's the holder of the plan and making recommendations across the chapters. But what we have experienced is that some submissions come along and they want a specific amendment to a definition that works for their property or some activity that they're contemplating in the future. But the implications of that change to their definition across the entire proposed, or volume one of the proposed district plan, have not always been contemplated by the person coming to you asking for that change. So, in response to your question, the exercise has been undertaken. And I think Ms.
Lee says
that in section 42A.
So the option that occurred to me is, rather than, as I say, somewhat boldly saying at the outset that the defined term is used in the defined sense in every single case, whether a more prudent, risk-averse approach might be to adopt the approach typically used in legislation and say, at least the context otherwise requires. Now, that opens up the potential for argument that might be better than creating this edifice that that on page 132 line, whatever, there is an exception that has escaped the eagle eye of the checker.
Yes, that the approach that you have suggested, I believe, is not one followed by the independent hearings panel in Christchurch. Their preference was instead to work through a process where the council and submissions were given an opportunity to provide submissions on any instance where the defined term should not apply. And that is a process that the council worked through in significant detail with the panel. And then submitters were given an opportunity to submit if essentially they didn't agree with the outcome. It's a process that worked well, but is incredibly resource intensive. And it possibly, I think, works better with the approach where you underline the definitions, and then if it's not underlined, that's when the ordinary dictionary meaning means, and there's no potential for uncertainty in the future as to what the correct definition is. I've been involved in consent applications where we are arguing whether it is the right, whether it does apply, the definition applies in that instance or not, because we're arguing about the context. And so I think if we can get that or any uncertainty out of the plan now, that is a desired outcome.
Whereas my point is that having found one exception, it makes me somewhat wary that there might be others. And since, and I don't particularly want to be the one that's volunteered to project them all.
The exercise that Ms. Lee has talked about, she might want to expand on that when she's presenting in section 42A. The reference in the introduction chapter might have been the focus.
Yes.
So, just moving along to paragraph 4.2. So, during the course of hearings, some definitions have been recommended, and they've been recommended to be included within a chapter. And essentially, this has happened because a new definition was asked for, and it related specifically to that topic, and therefore the section 42A author has essentially said, well, it applies to this chapter. I accept the definition and it's put into this chapter. As a consequence of considering it globally, it is a better approach that those definitions come out and go into chapter 2. If they were drafted purely for one chapter, and that is the specific restriction in their scope, then chapter 2 needs to say that. And in the chapter, that is...
Chapter 26 is the example.
It is, but I'm just thinking in this link evidence summary, attached to it is some updated recommendations, and that is where she has included in the context of chapter 26 only. So it's really important that when they come through to chapter 2, their scope is specifically limited. And there is one exception to that, and that is chapter 5, the Tangata Whenua chapter. There are a number of defined terms in that chapter, and the council's recommendations is that they remain there, but there is a specific reference over to them in chapter 2. One of the reasons is that the chapter was prepared in consultation with iwi, and that is the outcome of that drafting process, and it is expected to be an exception to the wider approach of bringing all other definitions into chapter 2, but it's considered to justify in this particular instance.
Well, I'll just interrupt you and give Ms. Leith a heads up that chapter 12 and 13, Ms. Cummings also recommended definitions applicable to those chapters dealing with development sites in Queenstown Town Centre and Wanaka Town Centre. And so I'd like you to look at those over lunch before we question her and see if she thinks they should be brought into chapter 2 as well.
Thank you. turn into the Desert Nations chapter and the evidence for Mr. Sullivan that's been filed on behalf of the Airport Corporation. Mr. Sullivan's evidence is that the definition of airport operator should remain in Chapter 2 because it is used in the Wanaka Airport Aerodrome Purposes Designation. The term is not used elsewhere in the Stage 1 chapters and therefore consistent with other terms not used in Stage 1 chapters. This leave has recommended its deletion. The Council's approach is that designations do not trigger the definition within Chapter 2 and therefore airport operators should be deleted.
Can I ask you a question about that, please, Ms. Scott? My understanding is that the designation chapter is part of Stage 1, and in terms of your saying that the Council's approach is that the designations do not trigger definitions. Is there anywhere in the notified plan that said that?
No, I don't believe there's anything in the notified plan that specifically stated that. If I can turn first, and then you might, this might answer your question, but you may have more. Just to paragraph 4.4, where it's accepted that a designation is included in a district plan as if it were a rule. But section 176 subsection 2 of the RMA then provides that the provisions of a district plan or proposed district plan, which includes the definition, shall apply in relation to that land that is subject to the designation only to the extent that the land is being used for a purpose other than the designated purpose. Therefore, the definitions are only relevant when the underlying zone is being relied upon, rather than the designation itself.
Yes, I did read that part of your submissions, and I put in my margin. Do you really think that was what 1762 was getting at? Because you have to decide what the designations mean, and
well, there are other purposes clearly of section 1762, but this is an implication of what that section of the RMA says. A designation, I go on to say, in written submissions, authorises the requiring authority's work and activities without the need to comply with the zoning rules or to obtain a land use consent. And it is therefore submitted that the conditions of the designations should be specific enough without referring to the definitions chapter unless necessary. Also refer there to section 37.1 of the designations chapter. It states that conditions of the designation set parameters for which the activity can occur in accordance with the purpose of that designation. So the conditions set the bounds of each designation, and only one of the designations includes a condition that specifically states a definition in chapter 2 applies. And I believe that came through a recommendation during the course of the designations hearing. And I refer there to paragraph 4.7 to both the Christchurch Replacement District Plan and the partially operative Auckland Unitary Plan, where the same approach is adopted.
Accepting the point submission you make for the purpose of the discussion, would it be clear? I also found the language saying designations do not trigger definitions rather curious. Could I ask Ms. Lee through you think about how that might be put in a plain English manner?
Yes.
The other question I've got that you haven't considered in this explanation as to how it occurs is section 171.1 says that when considering a notice of requirement, you have to have regard to the provisions of the plan. What does that mean that you would need to consider terms in the designation
if they were defined terms in the plan.
I believe the purpose of section 171 is where you are assessing an application or a requirement for a a requirement for a designation, and one of the matters that the decision maker, or the, what's wrong?
The
recommendation to take into consideration is what the district plan provides for in terms of particular zoning. That also goes to whether it's necessary to have a designation for that particular land as well. It is an interesting concept, and it's something I must say we've had. It is something that was specifically addressed in the Christchurch context, where there was a push from one submitter to have something relating to an airport defined through the designations chapter. Not that that's relevant to your recommendations, but it was something that was refused.
If we were to accept this recommendation of the provision at the beginning of Chapter 2, would it be helpful if, in making recommendations on those that require the council was actually in any term was in conflict with a term defined in Chapter 2, it recommended that the designation specifies that the term used in the designation refers only to the designation. Now, I can imagine there'll be instances where there will be terms used in a notice of requirement which might conflict with the way the same term is defined in the district plan. But there are other terms when they should be the same. I mean, a good example where they should be the same is the air noise boundary and out of control boundaries, because those are set in the district plan, but designation 2 requires the airport company to meet the noise limits within those boundaries. So clearly those definitions must be the same in both. So it can't be axiomatic that they are not the same, but if they are not the same, it should be made clear in the designation that they're not the same. And it may be that the definitions should be the same, unless stated to the contrary in the designation.
An alternative approach to plan drafting is not one that the council has
But where we do have defined terms in the district plan that are used in the designation, and the air noise boundary is the obvious one, then clearly they have to mean the same thing, don't they? Otherwise, the airport company can say, oh no, our air noise boundary is different from that, and so we can make more noise.
Yes, that example.
So there have to be instances where they are the same term. I would have thought definition of site is another example where you'd want it to be the same thing.
Yes, and these designations, a number of them have been rolled over from the operative plan without any changes to them. Some have been changes made. But for those that have been rolled over with no change, it was the operative definitions that would have applied to them when they first went into the plan, if that was the approach that was taken. And the requiring authorities have asked that there be no change to the designation, but this creates a risk that the way that the conditions of the designation might be interpreted or applied changes simply through rolling through to a new plan that has different defined terms within it. And that same situation applies for designations that are rolled over with modifications. Again, if it's something that's come from the operative plan and definitions are different in the proposed district plan, then that may well change the scope or extent or the way the conditions must be achieved simply by placing the designation into the proposed district plan rather than in the location within the operative district plan.
That does raise the question of the air noise conversion, doesn't it? So I think the Wanaka Airport was rolled over, wasn't it, without modification?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that. I wasn't involved in the hearing.
Queensland Airport is an issue because that's still subject to appeal, and that when that's settled, that will come in there. The question is whether the definitions used in the appeal are what are in the proposed plan now, because in both instances, on the basis of evidence and submissions from the airport company, the definitions have changed.
Yes. I can't speak to what's happened in the declaration and recommendations. I'm sorry, but I have taken a note on this and I will go away and have a
look. Yes. I think in most instances it's not going to be an issue, but the airport is probably the prettiest one.
Yes, and I also, if I'm not sure, the actual wording that's used in the designation may well specify the noise contours that it's referring to. I'm not sure.
Yes, so it specifies the one kind of plan, and it's fine.
Okay.
If you're that is all your submissions on the designation part.
It is, sir. I was going to move on, so it's now a good time to...
Yes, now is a good time to break the lunch.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you.